We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Dr. David Bureau says, while language can capture much of the diverse range of human experience, it fails us in the case of pain. This afternoon, we'll talk with Dr. Bureau about pain and his experience of pain following a bone marrow transplant. Dr. David Bureau is the author of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments this afternoon. Join us with a phone call or an email message in the Champaign-Urbana area. Our phone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address, WILL-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. David Bureau earned his MD from Columbia University. He also holds a PhD in literature from Oxford University. He teaches at he is in practice with his father in Brooklyn, and he teaches as well. In addition to his new book, In the Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief, he is the author of 100 Days, My Unexpected Journey from Doctor to Patient. The new book, In the Language of Pain, is published by W.W. Norton. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, the email will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Bureau, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Very good, very good. And where are you teaching? I'm sorry, I stumbled over that.
I am at SUNY, which stands for State University of New York, in the Brooklyn campus. So that's a medical school in the SUNY system in Brooklyn. And I teach dermatology as well as medical humanities. So I teach a course on medicine and literature for fourth-year medical students.
And do you talk about pain?
I do. I do. And I talk about patients, and I talk about language and how we communicate and how we can better communicate symptoms of illness, including pain.
Why is it so difficult to talk about pain?
It's difficult because, especially when we wanted to sort of describe the pain, as opposed to just talking intensity, you know, this pain is a 5 or this pain is a 10, but when we want to sort of describe the pain, it becomes difficult. It becomes difficult because, unlike describing things that we can see, that are out in the physical world, like a tree or a person, and we will say that that person has blue eyes or a certain type of hair will go on. It has a certain feel. We can, you know, describe in terms of our sensory, our perceptive powers. But in the case of pain, it's inside and invisible. And how do you start describing something that we can't see or hear? And so it becomes very, very difficult. So inherently, it's very difficult to describe. And add on top of that, usually when you're trying to do this, you're not at your best because you're sick, you're scared, So there's lots of things that go against you when you're trying to do something like this. And we're not even talking about the doctor who doesn't want to hear you. We haven't introduced that as another obstacle.
Yeah, yeah. How does a good doctor or nurse or other practitioner try to solicit a description of pain?
Well, that is hopefully what should happen. Again, you know, I was just at the doctor. I had a problem, and I found myself really struggling to put my symptom into words, and I couldn't believe it. I spent the last, 20 years thinking about pain and language, and I couldn't do it. So I think that it's extremely important because of the obstacles that we just talked about, that you really try to think and use your imagination to come up with some kind of a description. And it's incumbent on the patient, it's incumbent upon the doctor or the nurse to try to also use imagination and coax the patient into coming up with some kind of a description. Because if we don't, and if we don't describe it well, we might miss something, and we might not diagnose or treat a problem appropriately.
There is a story in the book about a patient you call George S. This mm-hmm. this speaks to people in healthcare who don't want to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
He had some surgeries for some back injuries, and he was told, "You're as good as new," but he wasn't.
Right. And this is a huge issue, especially for people who suffer what's called chronic pain, which is a huge issue and a huge problem in this country. And medicine is particularly bad when it comes to chronic pain, because medicine sort of focuses on the physical kinds of things that doctors can fix. And when all those things have been fixed, that's it. That's all medicine sort of offers. So a person like George S., who had a problem, the problem was the physical problem, the spinal injury, the disc was repaired, but then ultimately has pain that goes on forever, essentially, but there's no physical source that is detectable on any kind of imaging study or whatnot. Well, the doctors don't have a treatment for him. And those patients really suffer immensely as a result.
He became depressed.
Mm-hmm. Which is not unusual. There's a very high incidence of depression with chronic pain patients. There's also a very high incidence of suicide with chronic pain, because those people feel as if no one's listening. To tell somebody who is in pain that you've been fixed and there's nothing more you could do is devastating. I just reviewed a book called Inside Chronic Pain about a person who's sort of a woman just like George S. And these stories are so common that patients spend years of their lives in pain, going from doctor to doctor, no one being able to find anything that's fixable, quote unquote. And it's extraordinarily frustrating for them. It's frustrating not only because the actual physical sensation pain isn't going away, but added to that is this sort of psychological, existential kind of pain that no one's believing them, and they're increasingly feeling alone and cut off from the rest of the world. And I think that adds to the pain. So compounds the pain. So I think it's a very big problem.
And depression is you know, that is very deep pain.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that you are physically in pain and then you're in mental anguish,
mm-hmm.
and that mental anguish is making the physical pain worse.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found in writing the book is there's not really a fine line between the physical and the mental when it comes to pain. And what I mean by that is that many people who have physical pain also suffer all sorts of psychological pain, as well as many people who have psychological pain, say depression. Well, they have lots of physical symptoms as well. So there's a sort of spectrum, but there's never really, well, this is just one and not the other. And the other thing I learned was that I think in many ways, regardless of whether the source is a physical problem or the source is a psychological one, the experience of pain is felt actually more similarly than differently. We feel it in the same way. I think the basic feeling of pain is that there's something really bad happening inside us that we need to get rid of, get away from. And that happens whether it's a physical or a psychological pain. We feel it in the same way.
You talked about, though, that pain isolates us.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
All pain is isolating. All pain is isolating. It's isolating first and foremost because it's felt to be so sort of private and internal. No one else could feel my pain. Therefore, at the outset, you're sort of cut off from other people. And the longer that pain goes on, the worse that gets. That sort of tether with the rest of the world gets more tenuous and more tenuous. And that's why communication is so critical, because communication is a way to sort of reconnect one with the outside world, with other people, is a way to sort of share, at least to some degree, that very private sort of feeling. If it's possible, if you can get it across in words, in pictures, in whatever way you can, it's incredibly important and can be a sort of medicine, especially when you acknowledge how important that isolating quality of pain is.
Do some healthcare providers ask people to illustrate their pain? I mean, in terms of drawing something?
I think that it is a novel sort of approach. It's more useful. It's very useful, especially in the pediatric age group where mm-hmm. language is not quite as smooth and easy. But it's also becoming more popular in especially the chronic pain patient groups. One of the things that I talk about in my book is that there's this pain clinic in London where an artist helps patients draw, photograph, depict what their pain looks like to them, and then are able to share that with their doctors. And it's actually incredibly useful work, and may sort of A, get their doctors more invested in their care, and B, it's therapeutic for them. The feeling of A, having been able to sort of express, get out this private kind of feeling and put it out there in the outside world, and also feel that in doing so, they're not as alone as they were. So on several levels, it's really helpful. And I think, you know, given the difficulty of communicating pain, we have to think out of the box and unconventionally. And if words can't always do it, well, maybe pictures can. And in certain cases, pictures might be the way to go.
Also, I think what we want to talk about here this afternoon is literature and what it can tell us and how it can guide us in thinking about pain. In the chapter Literary Agency, this is something you talk about here. Should we start speaking like Jack London and Leo Tolstoy in front of our doctors? Say that our pain feels like cranes growling waves coming at us, that our emphysema feels like London's wind packing and swelling our airway with solid earth. That's a powerful metaphor.
Powerful. And it's powerful for you to read it and hear it because it really makes you see, in fact, makes you not able to not see that person's pain. And that's critical. So we do have to learn. And here I think literature is actually quite practical, has a practical value in this case. Pain is difficult to express. I say this over and over again because of the obstacles, the fact that we can't see it, the fact that it's inside us. So the way that we ultimately deal with that is to discuss it or talk about it indirectly, to talk about it in terms of things that we can see and touch and feel and hear. So essentially what we do is we use metaphors. That is the only way. It's necessary. In the case of pain, one speaks in metaphor. One speaks the language of literature. So if that's the case, well, then maybe we can learn from some of our greatest, writers. And I think it's true. In this case, we can learn. And I think it's essential we do so that communication gets to a higher level. And I think it's really useful and really needed in this particular instance, in the communication of pain.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. David Biro. He's the author, most recently, of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. Dr. Biro earned his MD from Columbia University. He also holds a PhD in literature from Oxford University. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about pain. You can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, with a phone call or with an email message. The phone numbers if you'd like to join us by a telephone call, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. And anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, you can use our toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. Our email, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. I mentioned in my introduction that you have some experience with pain, pain following a bone marrow transplant. And you say in this book, The Language of Pain, you experienced physical pain and psychological pain and could barely think straight. How did you talk about your pain with your doctors?
Well, I would have to say that in different ways at different times. So at one point, for example, I was really in just absolutely overwhelming pain. And at that point, there was absolutely no language. There was no communication whatsoever. And I do believe that at certain points when pain is at its worst, there really is no possibility of sharing that pain. At that point, you just sort of have to wait it out. And hopefully, at some point, the pain lessens, subsides a bit, and you're able to start thinking and acting again like a human being. I really think that at some points pain just shuts one down when it becomes overwhelming. But, you know, as I said, when it does sort of subside, then you're in a better position. And there were times, for example, when I was in a lot of pain because it was after the chemo and radiation, you develop a lot of these ulcers that go down your GI tract. And I remember that was extraordinarily painful. And I don't know that at the time I was describing this, but what occurred to me in my mind at that point was a sort of picture of these small little forests, these small little fires that were running down sort of my GI tract. That's sort of how I thought about what was happening. My sense is that even in those states where you can't really talk, you're thinking. It's hard not to think. When you're in pain, it's hard not to sort of want to sort of imagine what's happening to you when this is going on. So I had this sort of image in my mind, which eventually I did put into words when I wrote my first book, 100 Days. So it took me a long time to actually communicate the experience, but ultimately did. And there are also other instances, not just the physical pain, as I said. There's so much psychological pain in illness. You know, when you're extraordinarily scared about what's going to happen to you, when you're feeling totally cut off from the rest of the world, this also is an important source of pain that happens when you're seriously ill.
Yeah. So how effective is pain medication? How effective is pain management today?
I think there's no question that in certain instances it's very effective, and was so for me during my illness. But on the other hand, for many people, it's not, especially in the case of, say, the George S.'s or the people who are in chronic pain, who find that a lot of the medication not only doesn't help with the pain, but it also sort of causes other problems, causes sort of your mind to sort of be fuzzy and other kinds of complications. So pain medicine is good in many instances, but not so good in other instances. Which is also why we need to think outside the box when it comes to pain, whether in terms of communication or medication even.
Yeah. Well, at the close of the first chapter of this book, you cite a statistic that's quite disturbing. More than 50% of cancer patients didn't receive adequate analgesia, and about 25% of them were estimated to die in severe unrelieved pain. Now, those numbers are from Health and Human Services, and they come from 1994. You know, here we are 15, 16 years later. Where do you think we are today?
I think we're better. But again, you have to sort of decide on what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So in the acute kind of pain management, like the cancer pain, I think we're getting better all the time, and I think there's reasons for the. Again, part of the difficulty in that instance is in all these instances, there's many reasons for these numbers. The fact that doctors and patients sort of are fearful that using a lot of pain medication will make them addicted, which is really not true. There's problems with communication, getting doctors to sort of believe that you're in this tremendous pain and it needs to be addressed. That hasn't been. But as time goes on, I think we're getting better in those instances, the acute sort of pain. I think where we're really having problems is, again, is this chronic pain stuff. where we really don't have a lot of effective medicine or interventions, it's actually a huge problem. Even you know, it may not sound as dramatic as the acute pain in the cancer setting, but it's a huge problem, and the reality is that it doesn't receive as much attention as the acute pain in the cancer setting. And so there's not a lot of research, there's not a lot of attention paid to it, and yet the recent statistics show that about 70 people in this country experience chronic pain. So it's a terrible problem, and we can only hope that things will change for such patients. I mean, and they have in a little in small ways. For example, there's now a whole new specialty in medicine, pain management, which we didn't have 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. There are pain centers where people could go just for pain, as opposed to seeing their primary care physician for pain. So we're making headway, but there's still a long way to go.
Dr. David Biro is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener now calling in from Clinton, Iowa, on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have two questions, and they're related. The first question is, if we had two people, let's say twins, and one gets in an automobile accident, has back injuries, has surgery, the surgery does as much as it can, but for the next 10 years, the individual is in chronic pain and is taking Oxycontin. The other twin, who didn't get hurt, takes Oxycontin as a recreational drug. At the end of the 10 years, they'd both been taking the Oxycontin the same length of time. Does the fact that the first one was taking Oxycontin because the body needed it, does that somehow mitigate the withdrawal if both quit taking the Oxycontin at the same time? Or does the body not care why you're taking it in regards to the addictive factor?
Let me just stress, I am not actually a pain management physician, so I don't know the answer to that question. My sense is that it would probably be easier in the first case, because the body does need the medication much more, and so it would probably be a little bit easier for the withdrawal. But I don't want to. It goes a little bit beyond my expertise.
Okay, well, maybe the second question will too, but I'll ask it anyway.
Okay.
And it was the purpose of the first question. If you have someone who has chronic pain, and let's say they have a back injury or some other kind of injury, and that's all that can be done, and they're trying to reduce their pain medication, how do they know, as they're reducing their pain medication and pain's arriving, that it's a withdrawal pain, and then just try to gut it out because they know it's in withdrawal pain, or that it's the real pain from the underlying injury? Is there any way of telling? Is there any literature on that type of situation or phenomena?
I don't know the answer to this question. Is this something that's going on with somebody you know personally, or
no? I've known quite a few people who have had, over the years, chronic pain,
mm-hmm.
and have taken medication.
Right.
And my understanding is when part of the withdrawal is whatever hurts you normally hurts you even worse going through withdrawal.
Right.
And so if you would have arthritis, bad arthritis, and you're taking pain medication, and you have this chronic pain, and you decide, well, this is hurting my liver, I want to reduce the medication as much as I can, there's a threshold where you might be having withdrawal pain,
right,
which you work your way through if you keep it up, but it also might just be the real pain, and you shouldn't try to ignore it. So
yeah, no, that sounds like a real issue. I mean, one of the things, though, we do in medicine is we hate to sort of withdraw something and not do something in its place. So usually we're doing multiple things at the same time. So while we're withdrawing one thing, we might be beginning something else or manipulating, and usually people who are on pain medicine are usually on multiple kinds of things. So we're not just sort of taking away one and not manipulating the rest of the regimen. But again, I am not a pain physician, so this is not my expertise. My area of interest, and if you could say expertise, is on language and communicating pain.
Yeah. Let's go back to that and to the idea of communicating psychological pain.
Mm-hmm.
You write about William Styron and his recovering from depression. And once recovered, he wanted to describe what he had been through. And he had a really hard time. But anyway, mm-hmm. would you tell us about his memoir, Darkness Visible? How did he describe the pain of the darkness of depression?
And I really, really love that book. What amazes me every time I think about this is that here is someone, a Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, writer, a person who is so gifted with language, and even he, when the pain is, you know, bad, even he has no words. He describes the experience as being wall-eyed. He becomes like a wall, a mute wall. And again, I really do believe that in many instances when the pain is overwhelming, that's how we become. But as you said, eventually there's a need. There's a real need to get this toxic thing outside of you, to express it. You know, expression is, in a primitive kind of way, is just sort of getting it out, getting what's inside out. And so there is a need, whether we write a book or tell our spouse or tell somebody on an internet chat room, there's going to be a need at some point to talk about these things. And what I found is that the talking about the physical pain is relatively simple, is similar to the talking about emotional pain. So when Styron eventually recovers his voice, he uses the same kind of metaphors that people who are in physical pain use. In particular, we talk about pain in terms of weapons that are hurting us, impinging upon us. We talk about the knife that stabs us, or the gun, the shooting pain. Well, Styron uses the same kind of language. He talks about a howling tempest in his brain that's suffocating him. Again, this sort of damaging sort of agent or weapon that's hurting him. I also mention how Joan Didion talks about grief, the pain of grief, of loss. And she describes it in terms of these great big waves that are assaulting her. Mm-hmm. Again, that same notion of some kind of a weapon that's coming into you, into the body, and causing some kind of a damage and that you want to sort of avoid. That's sort of what the feeling of pain is, and you want to somehow communicate that. And using some kind of a weapon metaphor enables us to do that in a way, whether it's emotional pain or psychological pain.
Yeah.
I mean, or physical pain.
Yeah. I love the poem that you've included from Emily Dickinson.
Mm.
in the book. It's so short and it's so eloquent. Pain has an element of blank. And after that first word, pain, we have a long dash. And at the end of the line, a long dash.
Yeah.
So visually, we have blank.
Yes. It blanks us.
Yeah.
Like it did William Styron, and he becomes wall-eyed. It really, and this is another thing that I talk about in the book, that what it comes down to is not necessarily that there's a lack of words, but it sort of shuts you down. It shuts down our thinking capacity, our ability to think, our ability to function. And so it's very difficult to even start imagining, but it's a big sort of blur, a blank. And I think you're right. It's a great poem.
Oh.
Captures the experience very well.
At the close of the book, you say, pain is all-consuming. It actively swallows up language as it does everything else. Yet we struggle mightily to describe pain, and you say we need to do that. I think that struggle also offers us some hope in that it says we don't want pain to have the power to silence us.
Yes. Yes. I think that's it's important. And I think it's important to try as best we can. Maybe not all the time, but when we can. Because it's true. If we don't, then pain will have the power over us. If we don't, then we will sort of remain sort of cut off from other people in our own sort of private world of pain. So I do feel that there is actually ways to be able to break down sort of the wall of silence that surrounds pain. There are ways. So I hope it came across that there is hope to be able to share pain despite the difficulties.
Mm. What can we do when we're not in pain, but someone we know and love is in pain? How can we be more aware about where they are and what they're suffering?
I think it's so important to be sort of there, present, to acknowledge, to not sort of dismiss, because if the person who has the pain feels that this is private and unshareable and he feels or she feels cut off, well, then part of the thing we can do is to lessen that, to sort of be present, to sort of acknowledge and try to sort of understand. And try to be there and make that person feel less as minimally sort of isolated as possible. Mm.
Back to this idea of isolation once again.
There's
a story in the book about Oliver Sacks that's tremendous. He, at some point, he fell, and he hurt his leg very badly, and no one was around to help. Well, help eventually arrives, but when he's in the hospital, he reported feeling more isolated than he felt on the mountain where he had fallen and lay helpless.
Yeah, that's an amazing... what a crazy thing. But, yeah. That's what happened. He felt more alone in the hospital than when he was literally alone on the mountaintop. And I think that's not an uncommon sort of experience that patients have. That physicians, healthcare providers are not sort of seeing them, acknowledging them, being there. In fact, it was in the case of Oliver Sacks, where just like that George S. patient, where the physician comes and tells Sacks, "We fixed you up. Everything is as good as new. You'll be ready to go." And here he is thinking, "But no, I'm not well at all. In fact, I'm not fixed up at all." It's this sort of disconnect between what the person is feeling and what the outside world is saying and acknowledging, actually not acknowledging, that creates this extreme sort of isolation. No one's listening to him. No one hears him. So he sort of has this sort of isolation, feeling of aloneness, which is a common theme. Whenever one of the things that I do in my medicine literature course for the medical students is we have a couple of sessions on reading narratives of illness that have been written by patients. And over and over and over again, patients say that the experience of illness is so isolating. Even when there's lots of people around, even when your family, your loved ones are around, it's isolating. It is one of the most common sort of motifs of any kind of illness story.
And then is this part of the reason we find support groups so powerful, is that we're with people who know what's going on?
Absolutely. I think absolutely one of the things that's very compelling about the support groups is here's somebody that has the same kind of illness I have or the same kind of pain I have. They will definitely understand. And how reassuring it is that there is somebody that may understand. Absolutely. I think the support group concept is key and is something that really can't sort of be offered in a way by the support of family, religion in some ways, because, again, those people are outside the experience. So for many people, support groups are tremendously valuable.
One last question here before we have to wrap up. I'm curious about how people of other cultures and languages, what do literatures from other places and other peoples tell us about pain and how it can be spoken of?
That is a very interesting question. At least from the literature that I've studied, it seems to be pretty common. People of different cultures use the same kinds of metaphors, but obviously different cultures think a little bit differently about illness and pain. And I think there are cultures, for example, Eastern cultures that are much, much more willing to sort of accept and acknowledge illness and pain as a part of life, and less likely to marginalize the ill, the aged, than we are here in the West. But in terms of language, I think there's more similarities than differences.
Universal. Very interesting. One last question, and I'll have to ask you to be brief.
Sure.
We so often talk about, we use metaphors that are, the metaphors that we choose are often those of war, of the battleground. Are there other metaphors we could draw on that would be useful, that would be, that would give us a more unusual, a novel approach to describing pain?
Mm-hmm. No question. I would say the weapon is by far the most common and the most interesting, and really captures the experience of pain very well. But there are other ways. One of those ways is to sort of project one's feelings onto objects in the outside world. So, for example, K. Redfield Jameson, the psychiatrist who wrote a wonderful memoir about her manic depression, she talks about looking at the sunset and seeing blood, and sort of seeing in the sunset what's going on in her mind, the sort of spiraling out of control of her mind that explodes and blood spatters everywhere. So instead of having necessarily the weapon, she sees her pain in the external world. She sees it in the sunset. Mm. Sort of something similar when we say, you know, we feel like the gloomy sky when we're feeling a little blue. So we sort of project our feelings on the outside world so that we could see it better.
Yeah.
That's one way. And another way, last way, would be to sort of imagine what's going on in the inside world. So sort of have pictures of what's going on inside of us, like when I was trying to describe the pain I felt in my throat.
The forest from the fire. Ulcer, yeah.
With the fires. But again, that's sort of a weapon-like metaphor, but it's sort of visualizing the interior, which is invisible for the most part for most of us.
Hmm. There, we've got to wrap it up.
Okay.
Dr. Biro, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Dr. David Biro is the author most recently of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. The book is published by W.W. Norton.